那这个长老在新加坡开始回去，变成我跟我爸去 tapes 的，我很支持的。It's right that I should remind you of the evidence of his witnesses about the tapes.Called Mr. Taylor first. He was the deputy technical manager of the MI, and had experience dealing with tape recordings, the chief engineer with Philips, he was a member of a number of learned societies, and he had examined tapes at an early stage in January of 1970.He said, you all the others agreed, and if copying is well done, it's impossible to tell whether the tape was original or a copy. He said in those circumstances he could not detect any edits. The tape would be cut and joined on again with sticky tape, and then copied onto the fresh tape, nobody could tell.He was asked to look in particular at tape 3A and 3B, and he told you, as we now know, nobody disputes it, that 3B erases the conversation which is on 3A. The erasure, he said, was in the middle of the tape, and he gave him great concern. He was given an alleged history. That history, of course, was that it was the version of the first tape, and that could make it account for his concern.Did he show the mark? Could be construed as an editing mark. Somebody wants to start taking a specific point. His idea was this. He said it was an indicating mark. And he said that the part which was erased on tape 3A corresponded with a dubious part.Of the tape that is tape 4, that's not one which was before you, it's one which was prevalent in the Bronson and Harris case. So far as tape 5 is concerned, he found a break in the continuity after the phrase, let's put it in the car. That you can find in the lease basket if you want to take it, break the continuity there. And he said that wouldn't comply with the alleged history of the tape.There were a number of breaks in continuity of tape 13, tape 14, there was overload distortion during the music, no other tape before, it was recorded throughout its length. That's work from memory, because nobody has made the slightest criticism of tape 14 from first to last. When you come to consider the other tapes played on that day, tape 13,and 15, which is the Grundy one, you will find they are each the same length, and they've each got the same words. There's no criticism there. They have 14. They are the only one of the others, and for their same tape, except the exact same thing. He spoke of take two, being only a five-inch tape,which is recorded on this full track, and only run 15 minutes. He said it'd be foolish to switch it on if you wanted to record a meeting lasting longer than that. And then he had this nonsense. He heard 10 bursts, he heard 50 hertz hum. I'll deal with that in more detail when I come to the other witnesses to deal with it in more detail.All he did say, this is obviously common sense, isn't it? Well, there's expert evidence. What Mr. Taylor did say is that tape is as reliable as the honesty of the people who produce it. They are reliable, so is evidence.
So you come back to the reliability. Mr. Boyd, Mr. Marder, Mr. Waterbury, Mr. Waterbury.
He said, Phil, that if tapes 1, 3, and 5 are not entangled with pressure, then a great deal fits in the place of the logical explanation of the pairs. I have never suggested any repetition of words. We found no defects in their description. And he said, you do not suggest those tapes have been interpreted. No defects. You do not believe that those tapes have been interpreted. I do not suggest that the words we hear on the tapes were not uttered. Of course, it's those words we were hearing which were interpreted. Mr. Ford, was the second of the defendant's experts. He again had a large number of qualifications. He didn't include a university degree, but we should have done that day, but for that, attendant and Ford against Mr. Ford had a large number of qualifications. There's one thing about his evidence, however, which may attract you. That is, if we have written paper and still adhered to the rule of no, the tape recording should never be used in evidence. Well, experts in the evidence of court are normally people who have an open mind and give honest professional opinion. If you've got an open mind, your opinion is perhaps rather more valuable. If you approach the matter with a closed mind, that's a reflection which you may care to ponder. At all events, all four approach the matter on the basis of the case according should be used. Well, Mr. Ford said he wasn't satisfied with dispose of. Dispose of a mark on tape 3, which he referred to as editing mark, referred to by other witnesses rather than terms, as an indicating mark. He said that on tape 3, the indications were that the tape had been wound back after the recorder had been put into the recording mode, wound back and then started again so as to make the recording, which is 3B, which is the relevant conversation. I wound 50 hertz hum, he said, it should not be that. Tape 5, continuous recording, he said, and he said that there was a mark at the conjunction of the two recordings. That is said by the defendant to the sinister to indicate copying with that mark on that tape and on the other tape. Right, the waiting be quite useful. Someone take it over and over again for the purpose of filling out the transcripts, whether it's sinister or not. Found no defects at all in tape 14, recorded all its length, if there were 10 bursts, he found 50 hertz hum on tape 13, which he said shouldn't have been present. And what he said is the sum, this, I find it difficult to have much confidence in the recordings before the court. It also happens to be difficult to use and to hear his hurt. What weight you put on his evidence is necessary. True it is, Mr. Paul.
May I leave the court, please, Your
Honor? Yes, very much. How long have you been?
I'd like to be out of the court during your summing up.
I thought you were. On judgment purpose. No, I think you ought to be in court during the summing up. If you want to go downstairs for a few moments to have a purpose, you wasn't there. I think it would be advisable
to go. Your Honor, my sister will stay. I consider your summing up to be extremely biased, Your Honor, and I have great difficulty preventing myself from interrupting you.
You haven't heard it all. I think you really ought to stay. Now, I'm dealing with Mr. Gore. The view he expressed at the end of his evidence when he was questioned by the defendant was this: I find it difficult to have much confidence in the recordings before the court. He went on to say when he was cross-examined that there was no evidence that the recordings of speech which you have heard had been tampered with or doctored. He held the view that magnetic tapes should never be put in evidence. On tape 1, he said there was no evidence of doctoring or tampering. On tape 2, same thing. Tape 3, he said obviously combined as different recordings, and that, he said, is obvious. He didn't notice the marks on the 21st of September 1971 when he made the examination. Of course, they became then, and they were pointed out in afterwards. He said tapes 3B and 5 are of the same conversation, and he accepted that they were identical in length. The noise levels difference between the position of the microphones. One was under the dashboard and the other was on area. Noise levels, he said, are consistent with the position of the microphones, but he said it was not impossible to fake the recordings. And the counting, he said, and I've already mentioned this, must be done before the 3rd of December. Nothing to precise about tape 14. Tapes 13, 14, and 15, he said, were identical in length. He didn't investigate tape 15 in detail. The Times copy, he said, were identical in quality. And so he said, independently, it must have been done before the Times copy was made at the 4th of December. Psychic calm had always been on his mind. He had reported grounds for suspicion of copy. And you remember that he spoke to sinusoidal harm as well, and he spoke of the meeting on that particular day as between the two that was on tape one. The marks on the tapes, he said, are a complete mystery. The purpose of the marks is not clear. Mr. Kinney. The defendant's other expert turned to at a copy of a tape was really undetectable. Everybody agrees about that. He added too that the leader, if that had been used as a means of identification, could be readily replaced. Could be said that the boxes in school had been identified. He's of course that was done several years, but not a lot of doubt about their identification. But what is said by the defendant is that it establishes many more than that the boxes and spools have been identified. It does not mean that the tapes have been identified. The tapes which contain the conversations. That's what is right. But the identification of the recordings, of course, depends on the evidence of Roy, Panza, and those eventually played, because they have the tapes and they do that evidence, which identifies them, rather than the evidence on the boxes not proved. Although that evidence is, of course, helpful. But you follow the point which the defendant makes about that. Take one, said Mr. Kinnick, had no editing marks. There were 30 hertz tone bursts at the end of the tape. There were passages in factory rather than noise. He found 50 hertz hum in the recording of the telephone conversation. So he had a psychic beat, very much the same as 4 years ago. So, a hum of that sort was picked up off the telephone, but it was not originally sighted. The tape might be copied, he said, in conditions where 2 50 hertz hums were present. No marks on tape 2, no 30 hertz tone bursts. If there had been, it wouldn't be possible to detect them because it was a full length recording. Take 3, he said he didn't find 30 hertz tone bursts, he found 50 hertz hum and break in the recording after the speech interview. Originally, he said, 3A, that's essentially the bottom of the recording on that type, was longer than it now is. It was slowing up because of the battery running down. Remember the other evidence about that? The battery was running down in that tape. When K. Fast apparently made a noise like, then described as a noise like Mickey Mouse, more or less, his care now, the debt running down before he was erased, and he had 3 feet before he was on top of 3B with the shoreline. So 3B, he said, starts adjacent to a point on 3A, which Robson has in the case contained phenomena that were contested at their trial. Richard heard the sound, he said, surprises him enormously. Like an indication of coughing. On day 13, Mr. Hertz's hum was found at a low level, right towards the end, well past the speech area. And not satisfied that Mr. Hertz's hum could have arisen as part of the recording described. The emphasis of tape 14, no phenomenon apparently on the examining tape. So far as tape 13 was concerned, remember we had the theory, which was canvassed more than once after the conversation. It is suggested by the time that that time may have been produced by passing the interest of those diligent passengers. That is something which is not accepted by the defendant's experts. They don't have to appear to have done the experiment that they have made. It's put forward as a theory, I think, by Mr. Teller, or the Crown.
Mr. Ealy.
I'm sorry, Mr. Ealy. It's put forward as a theory, where there's no more theory. That's the way in which it could have gone on. The important part of it, of course, is the speech recording. And that is identical in length and content to tape 14, which is the one which never gets criticized from start to finish, and whether or not therefore there are passages of 50 hertz hum at the end, perhaps doesn't matter very much, and may not think it necessary to limit it, say, all the during a training we had in relation to the Mr. Paris and what people might not have to bear. Anyhow, that's something we have to consider for yourself. Mr. Kinnick also said that he never suggested that tapes had been fabricated in any way. I have never suggested, he said, that the people who created these tapes were responsible for the camera. On tape one, he said there was a possible innocent explanation for 50 hertz hum. He hasn't got a word to say against tape 2. He said on tapes 3 and 4, there was no positive evidence of tampering, cutting. He said that if anybody had fabricated or rigged tapes, that person must have had some skill and experience. Well, that's very obvious, isn't it? He believed Mr. Hyde. It was difficult to fabricate speech on the sort of one he has here. It's a good deal easier to remove a bit of a tape. He accepted that the noise levels on the tapes are consistent with different microphone positions, and that really goes to the second occasion when the number was one microphone on the head of one underneath. Therefore, those noise levels are consistent with the actual positions of the microphone. So if anybody has fabricated tapes, he has created 2 or 3 tapes. The more tapes in existence, the more difficult it becomes. So that's a copy system. Could take an indeterminate time to do it. I'm satisfied, he said, that all the words on these tapes were in fact spoken. And Well, I'll just remind you of what Mr. Hyde said about this. He was the expert called by the prosecution. He too had a large number of qualifications. He was engaged for 9 years in the speech research unit. He had a degree in electronic engineering, he was a professor of science, although I didn't get hold of it by itself. It makes him any more authoritative than the others. But the point about his evidence was that he was the only one of those experts whose speciality was in the speech research. Came into this case in October of 1970, worked on the tapes on the 21st of October 1970, 24th of January 1972. His work consisted of careful listening to the tapes to identify the contents, visual inspection of parts of the tapes, and instrumental analysis using instruments. He used a sound spectrograph, visual analysis, presenting a picture of the sounds used. He said that he never had under control custody of tapes, in the sense that the art experts tell you that the police were always closely supervising what they were doing. He examined the tapes carefully, he said, over a long period, but I know these to suggest conversations were edited or tampered with anyway. Well, that, of course, is rules out of it as well. They're not conversations, but from the other parts of the tapes. If the tapes are taken anywhere, I would expect evidence to appear on the recordings, but I found none. Subject matter is such that it would be virtually impossible to make substantial changes to the text. Well, that's an important evidence, isn't it? Written by someone expert, not just in text, but in something that way such that it would be virtually impossible to make substantial changes to the text. From the forties, if you take, and he said it's virtually impossible to take the cases trivial editing, he said, would be possible. If you tried to edit that critical phase, the result might be detectable. You'd have to practice, he said, on a copy. He agreed with Mr. Simon that he couldn't say with certainty, simply by listening to it, whether a tape was an original or a copy. That, of course, is something which all the others could be as well. Editing a copy would, he said, be undetectable if it was done in favorable circumstances. Well, it makes no difference to the quality of the recording, whether or not the tapes were virtual. Again, I don't think there's any excuse about that. It was put to him that tapes. With, you would accept that. So far as the criticisms of the tapes are concerned, the criticism made by the other experts in relation to 50 Hertz hum, 20 Hertz tone burst, marks and so on, says there's a perfectly innocent explanation, that is, that the tape was reused. There's no reason to come to a sinister conclusion that it could have been. No serious faults. He didn't think that anybody else had used a sound spectrum. Mm-hmm. Penner, who was one of those concerning the using the brass strip which you've got, which is certified D, gave you his evidence. He said he used both copies and originals in various brass strips. He then produced a demonstration tape, which purported to show that part of tape 30 had been played back in the car, remember, and recorded on tape 40. That's what he said. But in fact, that turned out, and he considered it to be a false one. He said they might in reverse. Remember that point in the evidence where you hear sounds of tape being run through a machine. But he said they had slowed that down, run it in reverse, and included from it what was happening, what the was made, and that was tape 13, tape in reverse. I'm sorry, tape 13 being run down. That turned out on investigation not to be so. The reason was that those two tapes, 13 and 14, are of the same version, and it wouldn't be possible to get them off the get the one off the time the turntable in order to have time to play that one and hope to still get it. That was the point that was made by the defendant, and it turned out to be right, and it turned out that Mr. Penner's demonstration tape was unhelpful in that respect. That's the point the defendant is entitled to get in his favor. The explanation may be that what is heard being whizzed round on that part of tape 13 is in fact tape 13. I'm sorry, tape 15, which was the little roundy one, which is the one losing his body. That's the explanation. Whether it matters or not, we'll be seen. I dealt with this point about the 50 hertz hum on tape 13 and getting there the crystal status. He did up his experiments and he put that forward as a possible explanation for the 50 hertz hum on tape 13. That was not accepted by the defendant's experts. Whether it matters to us, this is a matter for you. I'm not going to pursue at that point. What is important is that you should be charged that the taped conversations which were taped to you were in fact the tapes which were used at the material time. You want to show that those conversations are the original conversations. Lennon says that his expert evidence and the other evidence which he has led should leave you in doubt about that, or indeed should lead you to think that there are navigating tapes. You say whether that's so or not. Now, we have come to the stage now, and I think that all I say anymore, and I've not got very much more to say to you, it would be right for you to hear the material tapes once more. So, they would now be taped to you. They need to say this, all they are. But I'm sure you won't feel yourselves, you will not yourselves feel that you are being brainwashed. The tapes have been played to you once, And you can argue against him twice, certainly no, but he played you three times. Now, after very many weeks, I think it's right that you should tell him again before you die and consider your revenge. What I will tell you now is that if, when you are considering your revenge, you want to hear the tapes again, of course you can do so. That happens, you will come back into court. The court will be cleared, so nobody here except the officer of the court and the defendant's solicitor, and you can hear them dead again if you want to. It may be that once you've heard them now before you retire, you may find that that's enough. Anyhow, that will be to say because the decision of death is in your hands. Now, we will have the tapes played again, please. Number one. Two. Five.
Before they are played, you need me to correct a very small error of fact.
Yes.
That when you talked about Mr. Penner's demonstration tape, what in fact Mr. Penner at first said was, and your Honour was quite right when you said that he got it wrong, he admitted that he got it wrong, he at first heard tape 13, and it's on tape 13 that you can hear the winding back.
Yeah.
And he said that that must be tape 14, and he later changed it to tape 15. What your Honour said was that he'd heard tape 14 and said that that must be tape 13.
Yes, well, that's right. And now, we can take one. Now, four. You said, and today, points that you made out of it, look at that, are those points which indicate whether the defendant recognized or not recognized the head. And the other point is that by which not being said, I'd like to see you about that in and well, that's the thing that we developed before. And you now have to take watch, please.
I'm asked to say that the headphone machines are switched on if the jury wishes to use them. But there's no.
Well, there you are using the black machine, right? No, that's fine. You can use it without. There. You stay calm. Let me remind you again now, it is, of course, dropping here on the floor, which is the evidence. Not what is lying in front. The transcript is there. To remind you of the substance of it and to assist your recollection, but that's all. The evidence is what you hear rather than what you see. So now you hear tape two, please.
The head of the tape you played, or just the parts?
Oh, just parts of the voice.
Sure.
Enjoy the principally relevant part there, and we think it's on page 6. I'll see you about the other thing later on. That little later on carries a bit of burden, don't you? If I can scrape up a few quid, if you come up with a few quid, I can scrape it up, and then you get along safe. Yes. So now we will have tape 5, please. Remember the point the defendant makes, that is at the end of the radio, there's a noise which is on the door opening. And after the phrase, how you do a mimicking property, except said that there is a noise which indicates the door closed.